Reset, the podcast, is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand. Whether it's low alcohol or no alcohol, Liars helps you enjoy your classic favourite cocktails.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset, the podcast. A place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset. My guest today is Benny Higgins. His career has been one full of variety and seniority. The former chief exec of Tesco Bank is now chair of the Scottish Government's advisory group, amongst a whole host of other roles. In this Reset podcast, Benny touches on the power of magic and logic, and the juxtaposition of business and art that has become such an important part of his life. He views life as a classroom and talks very openly with me and honestly about how his own personal experiences, good and bad, have been his best teacher. Hi, Benny, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So you're in the Borders in Scotland, in your beautiful house there today, aren't you?
No, I feel very lucky. I think one of the things about the pandemic has been that it has shone a bright light on inequalities in life. And I've been a very lucky person to be able to spend most of the time, certainly all of lockdown, but also quite a lot of time otherwise in the Borders where, you know, you feel as though life is relatively normal. That's a great place to be. I'm very lucky to be here.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about that because I think, you know, I've known you for a long time now. For me, you are one of the most extraordinary people that I know. And not just because you've achieved great things in business, but because also you have a real love for the arts, for poetry, for literature, for your family. I'm going to talk a little bit about that today. And you know, we were talking about it. I think what sums it up is this concept of lived experience and learning. So maybe we'll have that as the theme. Let's start when you were young, because you didn't kind of want to be a banker. You wanted to be a professional footballer, didn't you, at the beginning?
Well, much to my father's amazement, growing up in working class Glasgow, I didn't want to be a footballer at all until I was about 12, and I refused to kick a ball, and I used to stay in the class with the girls drawing and painting, which maybe was part of the start of my affection for that. The painting, not the girls. But then around 12, I decided that I did like football, and I then spent, you know, a lot of my life playing football, therefore became an obvious hope and aspiration to play football seriously. And I was lucky to end up playing up to, pretty seriously up until I was about 18, 19 with Celtic, which was the football club that I'd, you know, effectively been born into, which is the way it works in Glasgow. So I had no choice. I didn't get to choose who I supported, that was given to me.
And given to your birth.
Being able to put on the green and white hoops was a great privilege.
Yeah, gosh, absolutely. But then you went to the University of Glasgow, you got a first degree in maths, and then you kind of began your career, didn't you, at Standard Life. What made you, and you were an actuary, and I love this fact about, for a long time, you were the fastest, I don't know, how do you say it, the person to become an actuary the quickest.
Fastest qualifying, yes.
And you held that for quite some time, but what is it about your brain that makes you able to do that? Because, you know, a lot of people talk about, you have an extraordinary kind of brain. When did you first realise that you were kind of more clever than others?
I think it's quite hard to pinpoint when you feel as though you've got cleverness. And cleverness in its own is a commodity. You know, if you're clever and you're good at doing algebra, you might not be very productive at doing things that require other qualities and other insights, and, you know, certainly emotional intelligence. I mean, interestingly enough, I was lucky enough to be good at school, and it mattered to me. So it was both football and school was important. It was important to succeed. It was important to succeed principally because I had personal pride, and I think that's what's driven me on from the start. But when I was approaching the end of my school years, you know, in Scotland, you left school in those days at 17, so you didn't do a sixth year. So our final year, as it is today. And I had to choose what to do. And I basically chose maths because it was the subject I excelled most relative to my, you know, school friends in. And I chose Glasgow University because it was the closest, what I thought was very good university. And I stayed at home. So I didn't really have what you would describe as a, you know, when people talk about their great university days, I mean, I don't really remember much about university other than studying, getting my degree and actually playing football while I was at university. I sort of kind of stumbled straight on to just an extension of school and didn't make this. I mean, when I speak to my own children, I speak to other young people who are making choices, they're much more informed choices about what might be best for them. And it's worked out okay for me, but I was basically just following my nose. And then again, I tried to do the best I could at university. And as I got towards the end of university, I was trying to work out what I'd do, and I narrowed it down to being going into the actuarial profession or doing a PhD. And an actuary came in, and I liked him as an individual. I liked the way he spoke. He said that the actuarial exams were really difficult, which perversely attracted me. And in my first day at Standard Life, I had lunch with three really nice guys who remained friends for a very long time. I don't see them now, but it's for no reason other than lives sort of move on and diverge. But they had all been doing the exams for literally years in each case. And I remember going back to my desk after lunch on that first day, and I decided that I would either qualify in record time and get on with the rest of my life, or I would give up. And I qualified in record time.
And how long was record time, Benny?
Well, I joined Standard Life in August of 1983, and I qualified in the June of 1986, so it's less than 3 years.
Wow, amazing. But, okay, so your career got off to a pretty fast trajectory. When did your love of poetry and the arts start? You're sitting, not that people can see that are listening to this, but you're sitting in front of an amazing bookshelf, which I love because it's not in beautiful order. It's just, you know, higgledy-piggledy, all sorts of books all over the place. And I know that's only a fraction of the books that you've got there in your office at home. So when did that love start?
My maternal grandfather was a you know, voracious reader, very politically, stood for the Socialist Party of Great Britain as an MP, didn't get in, needless to say, but he did stand. So he was very political, but he was very interested in poetry, very interested in literature. He had something like 18 grandchildren, and my mother and the rest of her siblings say he was the worst father they could have ever have had. And all my fellow grandchildren didn't get to know him at all. And for some reason, as a very young child, he sort of picked me out. And I used to go and spend most of Sunday with him every week from the age of about four. And all he did was talk to me about books and interesting things. Probably some things he talked about he shouldn't have been talking to me about, but that might have left its own indelible mark, I'm afraid. So that's where it all started.
Amazing. When I first met you, you were the chief exec of Tesco Bank, which was, you know, an extraordinary job. Because just talk me through a little bit of a couple of the things that you did, because you were very brave, and we'll come on and talk about your leadership in a minute. But you had a very clear vision for what you wanted Tesco Bank to be and how different you wanted it to be from other banks.
Yeah, so I joined Tesco in 2008. And it was at the height of the financial crisis. It was actually just prior to the height of it, in fact. And Tesco had agreed with RBS to buy the joint venture out and so be wholly owned by Tesco. And I was asked to discreetly and actually act secretly to run the transaction for Tesco. The reason why it was a secret was because it was judged that Fred Goodwin, who had been my boss for 8 years, wouldn't be too happy with me being on the other side of the transaction. Anyway, my secrecy was protected for a period, and then I think somebody saw me somewhere that gave it all away, and it then became not so much of an issue. But it was a unique opportunity to, I mean, the kind of fallacy is that I would meet people in the street and they would say to me, it must be wonderful to have a blank sheet of paper. It must be wonderful to have bought a bank. All of these statements, none of which were true. We hadn't bought a bank. All we'd bought was the right to build a bank. And the blank sheet of paper was probably the most terrifying thing you could face, because we had 5 million customers. We had to look after them. We had to build a bank in 3 years while we were running it off the platform RBS. So it was both the most exhilarating and the most exciting thing, all down to picking the right people, as always, and being decisive. You're better off, you know, make the decision you make right rather than worry about making the right decision. And we had to do that on a number of fronts. And I think we got lucky in some, unlucky in others, but we just kept pushing on. And there was a chance to build a bank that was a bit different. And I think we did do that. It's a shame today, you know, the bank, partly because of COVID, partly for a variety of reasons, is not quite what I had hoped it would become. But, you know, in all fairness, as they say, it was fine when I left.
And, you know, you have a very particular style as a leader. You have great loyalty from the people who work with you, and some of the people have worked with you for a long, long time. Tell me a little bit about what's driven you to be a leader and what you think is important as a leader.
I think leadership is hugely important. You know, we're living in times today where it's, you know, quite palpable that there are very big differences in leadership. I mean, it's quite an interesting aside that I think women in positions of political leadership are doing a lot better than men. It may well be the particular women and the particular men. But nevertheless, you know, if you look at actually Scotland, if you look at Germany, Finland, New Zealand, and compare that with Brazil, the UK, the United States, I think you see quite differences, big differences. And I think one of the distinctions that could be made there is authenticity. I think authenticity lies at the heart of strong leadership. It's not everything, but without authenticity, I don't believe people have the same confidence in you. And authenticity blends very much with the creation of loyalty. And humility is so important. I mean, I've been doing some lectures about, you know, the influence of literature and art on leadership, of what is on my leadership, and of what I think it can be in many. And one of them is the interesting sort of the fascination with words. And so one of the distinctions I make is the difference between modesty and humility. There are lots of very successful leaders who say they're modest, who try and behave with modesty, but they don't demonstrate humility. And I think humility is also what allows you to work with different people in different guises. So I get asked quite often, because I've been working with the Scottish Government very closely and the First Minister very closely for the last 3 years, somebody asked me the other day, how do I manage up to the senior ministers? And I said, I don't manage up to anybody. I don't manage down to anybody either. I treat the person at the front desk at St Andrew's House the same way I treat the taxi driver that got me there, and the same way I treat the First Minister when I get to her office. And I think that is an important thing. But that, I think humility is about understanding the boundaries and limits of your own expertise and your own impact, and it allows you to tap into the strength of others. Modesty doesn't. Modesty and often can often be fake as well.
Yeah, you're so right. And, you know, I've seen the way you are with everyone, actually. You're very similar. I really hate people, and you see it particularly actually with businessmen, obviously women too, but, you know, that kind of it going into a restaurant and treating people badly because they're serving you, or at a door, or, you know, they get, you're absolutely not like that at all. And is that partly your upbringing, do you think?
Yeah, you see that. I think there is this quite interesting debate at the moment about lived experience and how important it is. It's an influence, but you know, it's not only people who have lived in poverty that can be charged with understanding it and doing something about it. It's not only people who have a disability who can be charged with making changes that will improve the life of those with a disability. My identity has been shaped by all of my life, but starting off where I did in the world I lived in is a part of it. I mean, what's quite interesting is it's not just about the judgments you make or your identity, it's language. I'll give you a good example. My first home was a tenement in a little street called Daisy Street, which is very sweet sounding, in Govan Hill in Glasgow. And 2 years ago, I was approached by one of the biggest charities in Scotland, which is called Sistema Scotland, which basically takes music, orchestral music, into deprived areas to give the kids not... The music is the vehicle, but the outcome is confidence, courage, optimism, curiosity, all the things that you would hope that children would have in life. And one of the four centres is literally 100 yards from that tenement. And so to be chair of a charity that's looking after kids in the very area where my life started is quite amazing. But one of the points of raising it was that Nicola Killeen, who's a wonderful, wonderful lady who is the chief executive, before I did my first sort of press interview with Richard Holloway, who was the outgoing, he's an amazing man. I would, anybody wanting to read a book which sounds depressing but is very uplifting, Waiting for the Last Bus, which is clearly about death in its sense, but actually it's an extraordinary book, and he is an extraordinary man. But when I was preparing for it, I was advised to be very careful about the words I used, which I tried to be anyway, but specifically I was given a list of things that you're best not to say, such as, you know, underprivileged, you know, facing challenges, lots of things that historically there is a risk that the audience think, actually, I don't want to be described like that, you know. I did my interview, and afterwards I said to Nicola, I said, Nicola, halfway through that, I forgot what the list was. So I couldn't remember what I was supposed to say and what I wasn't. So I just kept going. And she said, well, to be honest with you, you've got to be careful. We've all got to be careful, but you can say whatever you like because people see you as one of them.
Yeah, gosh, that's nice, isn't it? That's lovely.
And so I don't think that lived experience is unique in giving you insight, because there's lots of that would be a very distorting way to view leadership or view how we sort of adopt policy in government circles, etc. But it's an influence. But I think what I've understood is it gives you an ability to empathise. But then, you know, I'm currently the executive chairman of the Clue, and you know, he's the second biggest landowner in Scotland. It's an aristocratic family. They're wonderful. They have the same values as me. I spent yesterday with the Duke and the Duchess and his son and his wife, who are the Earl and Countess Dalkeith, talking about the strategy for the future. My lived experience doesn't actually help me think about land ownership, but I've got to do it. And I think I can do it. So I don't think lived experience is the only route to intelligent decision making. I think the way you think about things is important. You know, that's another thing.
I think you're absolutely right. Your family are very important to you. You have, how many children do you have?
I have six children and two stepdaughters.
Six children and two stepdaughters. So that's quite a lot, quite to keep you busy. And I know that they're very important to you. And you know, you talked about being courageous and having values. And, you know, I haven't met all your children, but I've met some of them. And I would certainly say that you have helped them be curious and courageous. How have you been as a dad? How have you helped your children?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think by any conventional measure I would get a very good score as a dad. I mean, I've not spent anywhere near as much time around them as perhaps they would have liked or I should have. It's been a pretty fractured, you know, pathway. I mean, it's a matter of public record that gets quoted every time I'm in the press that I have been married five times. My two stepdaughters are with Sharon, who, you know, had them in her previous marriage. The other six children come from four previous marriages. I'm very lucky that I have lovely kids. I try and do my best for them, you know, but I wouldn't sit here pretending to have been some kind of ideal father, because I think I should have spent more time with them and I didn't. And I may regret that in time, but, you know, you can't go back in time. You've got to lean forward and try and make the most of the future.
If you were to do it again? I'm not sure you're somebody who's very retrospective anyway, but would you do things differently? Do you think you could have had the career you've had and been a different kind of family man?
Yeah, I think I could have. I don't think there was nothing. You know, I have any success I've had professionally has been despite the upheaval of going through, you know, broken relationships or marriages. They have not contributed to it. And my career hasn't contributed to that either. My career was, I'm very good at compartmentalizing things. I wouldn't for a moment say that somehow or other I was some kind of cliche of so determined to focus on work that I neglected home life or something. I mean, that would just be a complete and utter myth. It's just that relationship didn't work out for a variety of reasons, but maybe what I've got today, which is, I think, what distinguishes it from what I've maybe had before, is a real sense of companionship, which is something my first ever secretary in Standard Life, Isabel, said to me. I think what you need is a really good companion. But when you're at the time I was, 33 or something, companionship wasn't high on my list of objectives. But she was right.
But that's lovely then, isn't it? So with Sharon, you've obviously found the right companion. And what else gives you deep joy? Because you're not, you know, as you said, you've got a number of different roles now. You've made that big kind of, I guess, you've made that big reset from being a full-time chief exec into a much more of a kind of plural life. How have you made that switch? How easy has it been?
I think, to be honest, I was probably always better suited to this because I have a restless curiosity that actually, I mean, I would also say that if I was to use a rather bleak analogy, that without question, I'm more of a wartime general than a peacetime general. Peacetime sort of bores me and I'm at my most sort of dangerous probably. And if I am in peacetime, I've got to create a crisis, which you know, can be done. You know, you can manufacture. I mean, that's what big projects are, actually, in some ways. They probably prepare you for crisis management better than anything else. But I don't really feel as though I've had to adapt at all. It's a much more engaging life for me. I'm spending time in government circles, having been doing some really big projects that could have a very big impact on the future of Scotland. As I said already, I'm executive chairman of Buccleuch Estates, which is so different to anything I've ever done before. Has a big property portfolio, which, so, you know, the financial training is not irrelevant. I'm the chairman of a charity. I'm chairman of the National Galleries of Scotland. You know, I'm doing a lot of different things that require, I suppose, some subtle differences about how you go about them. But, you know, I think it's achieving things and connecting with people. I had a lovely little, if I can tell you this little anecdote, one of the things I do is I'm a visiting professor at 4 universities in Scotland. And I, about 3 years ago, I went over to Malaysia to the Heriot Watt campus and I gave a lecture I did two lectures, one on leadership and one on a case study around Tesco Bank. And on the first day in Scotland when you could actually get a takeaway, I went back up to Edinburgh from the borders. And Sharon and I went into the little takeaway and somebody said it's cash only. So I said to her, I'll just go and get the cash. So she stood there waiting, making the order. And when I got back, she said, oh, the lad behind the counter wants to speak to you. And his name is Jaffer Abedin. And he said, I just wanted to say, Benny, I really enjoyed your lecture in Malaysia. And last week I got a first in finance and accounting. And I don't know if this is ridiculous, but I'd like you to be my mentor. Oh. Would you do that for me? And that sort of thing is very kind of heartwarming, you know, because, yeah. You know, I went out there to do my best. I tried to give the young students an insight into things I've experienced, hoping that it would have an influence on them. So to even just meet one person afterwards, yeah. And I told Heather McGregor, who's the Dean of the Business School, and she was absolutely thrilled to hear that that connection had been made. But
that's a lovely story.
That's what life's about, you know.
Yeah, gosh, I know, I love that story. That's really lovely. I like that point that you made about, you know, maybe you are more suited to this. And I'd just like to cover a couple of things. I remember the time when at Tesco, they really needed to refinance the business, not just the bank, but the, you know, the whole retail business. And you, over a period of a few days, helped them do that. That was that kind of moment of crisis. Now, obviously, you know, you probably can't tell the ins and outs, but just briefly, just talk me through what you did to do that. Because I think for me, that kind of sums up the kind of man and leader that you can be.
Yeah, I think if I could say a little immodestly, I think it is the thing I'm best at, is dealing with a difficult problem that needs solved and needs solved quite quickly. I'm actually working on a couple of things at the moment for government that literally I need to solve them in the next few weeks. And that thrills me. And I was doing I've been doing a thing with Edinburgh University recently where they've taken the creation of the Scottish National Investment Bank, for which I was the architect effectively, and using it as a case study. And one of the things they were very intrigued by was the way I confront a problem and how I approach it. So it made me think quite a lot about it. And there's one of the things I think originally it was a French saying, which is appetite comes with eating. But there's another one, which is ideas come with speaking. And I'm a great believer in, you know, often I think people would think in a rather kind of normal sense, speaking to somebody's about giving them information. But I think when you're trying to solve a complicated problem, speaking to people is about learning for yourself. And one thing I have developed is a confidence in the kind of gradual completion of thought, if you like, so that things are happening in a relatively chaotic, random way as I'm starting to absorb the different facts that will help me solve them and different perspectives that will help me solve the problem. So in the case of the, you know, that was a very well-defined problem. So that helps. But I basically was in Italy having lunch with my secretary and two other friends from Tesco Bank. It was a giddly weekend. And I was, that was me showing off Italy to them. And I got a call from the new chief executive's office, Dave Lewis. Now, when you're only a few days into a new chief executive and he's your boss and he gives you a call on a Sunday at lunch, you're kind of quite concerned that something's gone very badly wrong. And I always assume that it must be me. So anyway, I kind of was relieved that it was only the audit crisis and there was a big hole in the finances. So once I got over it, it wasn't about me and it was about something else. And he basically said, you need to come back immediately and we need to basically find £5 billion of contingency funding by a week tomorrow. And I led the treasury team to go around the city and raise £5 billion of contingency funding. And I set myself the target of the Thursday, since I thought just doing it in a week would seem a bit lazy. So we did get there, although it's quite interesting. Some of the bankers were saying, you don't need it till the Monday. Why are you saying Thursday? I said, look, I don't need to explain to you why I need it for Thursday. It's Thursday. And when we went off some of the calls, the team themselves said, why are you saying Thursday? And I said, just because that's what I want to get it done by. And so we did. And it was totally thrilling, as these things can be.
I always remember you saying to me, one of the greatest things you can do, and I say this to loads of the people that I mentor now, is practice making decisions. Because then when you have to make the most important decision, you know how to do it. And we've seen that a lot, haven't we? People don't make decisions anymore. And the thing I love about you, Benny, is you do make decisions. And they might not always be right, but you are very good. And when those, as you say, that kind of big moment comes, you get it right.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it is right to practice. But and actually, that's because actually this is the lived experience point, that if you've made decisions and you've known how to deal with them, whether they're right, wrong, or in the middle somewhere, you get more confident about doing it. And I think that's, you know, there's a wonderful little anecdote that when in the 19th century, James Abbott Whistler was suing John Ruskin, who was an eminent art critic at the time. And it was all around the fact that Whistler, who was a kind of American from Massachusetts, but was, you know, central to the British aesthetic movement. And he had produced a painting in an afternoon, which Ruskin had criticized. And when he was being cross-examined, Whistler was asked whether he could justify this painting being a masterpiece on the basis that it had only taken him an afternoon or whatever. Whistler said, it's not an afternoon's work, it's a lifetime of knowledge. And I think that's the whole point of experience. But you've got to develop experience. And if you avoid making decisions, then when you need to make them, you're going to be less well prepared. We get better at things as we progress. We only get better by practicing, whatever it is.
Look, you are working with the government at the moment and with Nicola Sturgeon and the others. What's been the biggest challenge there?
Well, first of all, I would want to say that the private sector individuals often say that, you know, government's useless and government's slow and it's ponderous and all of the above. I've worked in a lot of big organisations that have had a lot of ponderous people and a lot of people who take forever to do things and don't make decisions. So this isn't the, you know, exclusive preserve of government. It's true of big organisations, frankly. Some are better than others, of course, and they are the ones that succeed most. I've met some of the most able people I've ever worked with in the Scottish government officials group. Very intelligent, very able. But if there was one thing that can be a frustration, you've got to be careful with it, is that there is an adherence to process that sort of transcends the output. So what do I mean by that precisely? If you're wanting to make sure you don't take too much risk, then the biggest risk is you don't adhere to process. If you adhere to the process and it doesn't get done, people won't be happy, but you won't get clobbered. If you've stepped out of process, then, you know, then that's a danger. And what I've had to try and do, and the expression I've used to try and explain this, is that I think in order to come into that environment from outside and make it work, you have to be prepared to rock the boat, but not sink the boat. And I think that's something I probably bet. I wouldn't have been able to do this 15 years ago, because the boat would have sunk. But now I'm no less ambitious and no less impatient. But I think I'm slightly more subtle and able at sort of doing it in a way that gets the job done without upsetting the whole apple cart, as they say.
Yeah, that was that lived experience bit again, isn't it? Is that, you know, having learnt from it, evolved. I want to come back again, just before we finish, to, again, your love of poetry and art. And we did a Burns Night Supper together a really long time ago now, actually, for Macmillan Cancer Support, which was a charity. And I was on their board of trustees for a long time, and you wanted to help me raise some money for them. And I think two things struck me about that night. One, your love of Rabbi Burns and your ability to stand up for 25 minutes with no notes and not only talk eloquently, but also quote his poetry. And, you know, I've seen you in business environments be able to speak very eloquently, but I think there's something very special about that. But also, you had people there as guests from all walks of life. And it comes back to this point you made at the beginning. You know, you had everyone from Fiona, your lovely secretary, through to the guy, I think he'd done some painting at your house, through to the gentry and the bankers of Scotland and England, all there together, all mixing together, all part of to be there to support you, to help Macmillan. That's an extraordinary thing to do, I think, and bring that together. Do you reflect on that and think, you know, is that what motivates you to just, you just love bringing people together? What is it that makes you do that?
I don't think it motivates me. I think it's the consequence of how I live. I treat all these people who, whether it be the Duke of Buccleuch, who I treat as a very, very good friend, I have the greatest respect for him, through to anybody I encounter in my life in any way. So it's not my objective, it's the consequence of me treating everybody exactly the same. I do think, I'm sort of surprised that so many people think it's unusual. I can't imagine anything else. And I don't think it takes any special talent in a sense. You know, it's just being willing to treat everybody with, I suppose it's back to humility, you know. And I think the other thing is that, you know, Joan Didion wrote a wonderful essay for Vogue back in the, I think it was the 60s, and it's all about self-respect and the importance of self-respect. I think self-respect and humility go hand in hand, and they lie at the heart of how you connect with people. And those connections are extremely valuable. They help you understand the world. they make the world a better place for you. I just couldn't imagine an alternative life in that sense.
Well, that's interesting. Self-respect, I think, is one of those very often misunderstood concepts, isn't it? Because so often we think self-respect needs to drive us to behave in a particular way, but it also stops us from doing things. What do you mean by self-respect?
I think self-respect is actually closer to the concept of humility, as I described it, which is not... Self-respect is that you can acknowledge you got it wrong. You can respect yourself and get it wrong. Self-respect, I think, leads to courage, because you have that. If you don't have self-respect, courage is a very difficult pursuit. So, yeah, I mean, if you've got it wrong and you're prepared to tell people you got it wrong, that for me is in some ways, the encapsulation of what I mean by self-respect. You know, you got it wrong, but you respect yourself. You tried to get it right. And I think that can lead to courage. It also underpins the humility that connects you with people, because that's what connects you with people.
I think.
And what I mean by humility is understanding the boundaries of yourself. That doesn't mean having humility doesn't mean that I can't tell somebody that I could recite, you know, a 10-verse poem at a moment's notice of Robert Burns or Robert Frost or whoever, because I can, you know. But this is where the modesty, you know, maybe somebody's modest wouldn't mention it, but they might not have the humility.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's that balance, isn't it? That's that balance. Another just, you know, anecdote that I love is you used to spend, when you were particularly working in London, a lot of time at the Soho Hotel, and they created a cocktail for you. Now, I think it was called the Higgins. Is that what it was called?
Higgins number 5.
Higgins number 5. What's in a Higgins number 5?
Well, maybe just to put it in some context, it was just ahead of the Olympics in London, which seems like yesterday, and it's, what, 8 years ago? Goodness.
Wow.
Anyway, I wandered into the hotel about midnight, and the Soho Hotel bar tends to, I think it always closed about that time. So the barman, who I knew everybody in the hotel because I'd been almost living in it for the best part of 10 years, and as I walked in, one of them said to me, we're doing some cocktails to name after some of our special guests or people we've got a special relationship with, and we'd like to do one with you. Would you mind? I mean, did I mind? I couldn't stop myself from sort of the thrill of it all. So anyway, they then said to me, well, we'll just make one up and call it whatever you like. And I said, oh, no, I've got to do this myself. So at the time, I had been in and out of Italy quite a lot, and I was drinking Negronis. And I said to the waiter, do you think we could make something that's a bit like a Negroni, only different? And he said, yeah, sure. And my little twins at the time were very fond of berries, like raspberries and blackberries. So I mentioned that, and they said that they would stick that in it as well. And then they said something that sticks in my mind, which was, we've got to make it sweet enough for women to order, because the cocktail market is more women than men. And so we effectively made it into this really incredibly strong, sweet Negroni, which I have to say, on the basis of a few people that shared a few with me, proved to be very lethal. But the other funny thing, Suki, is that I decided that I'd keep it quiet, because I think I was at Tesco at the time, and it didn't seem like, you know, having a cocktail named after you at the Soho says quite a lot about your habits. So I thought, I won't tell anybody. And the following day, the marketing director walks into my office in Edinburgh and says, I hear you've got a cocktail named after you in the Soho Hotel. So that secret was out pretty fast.
Yeah, that absolutely. Well, I did have a few with you, and probably at close to midnight when we, you know, I think there's two kind of iconic moments with you. When we were working together at Tesco, where regularly I would come and see you, and there was a lot going on at that time, and you would sometimes be just sitting there, actually sometimes just sitting there with a coffee, you know, thinking, not with loads of paper in front of you. Or in the evening, you might have a glass of wine or a Higgins and a poetry book. But the second you get into the work piece, you would be completely on it. And I think your point about compartmentalizing is something that many of the people who've worked with you, who know you, can see. But I think what the joy of you is when you can kind of join up those dots and kind of bring them together. Just finally then, Benny, what are you looking forward to in 2021? This has been a very challenging year for a lot of people, I know. But what are the positive things you're looking forward to as we come out of this, hopefully, COVID time?
Yeah, I think the problem we've got at the moment is we're dealing with incalculable uncertainty. And, you know, like everybody else, I just hope that we can all get to the other side of this pandemic, whether it's living with it in a much more manageable way, or indeed it's through a vaccine or treatment that lets us get back to a normal life. I think that's all we could all hope for. And I think hope that the economic damage is somehow managed by governments around the world, in particular in the UK and in Scotland itself. And it lets us get back to focusing on what's possible. So I think it's very hard to, it's a very difficult time to look beyond something that is so uncertain. But I think, you know, it does bring us back to kind of leadership and a crisis and so on. And I think the one thing you've got to do is not lose in any pursuit that you're involved in your sense of purpose. I think you've got to make sure that you continue to have ambition, because it's too easy to puncture your ambition in these uncertain times. And then perhaps most of all, and it's difficult, is to continue to live by the values that you think are most important and not ditch them because it's more convenient in such a unpredictable, unimaginable time.
Yeah, I think you're very right. Thank you, Benny. As always, an absolute joy to talk to you. Thank you for being so open. Thank you for sharing both your work and your personal life with me today. And thank you for just telling you some of those stories, which some I haven't heard before, but the ones I've had, I always love hearing. And it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed Reset the Podcast, I'd love it if you would forward it to your work colleagues, friends and family. Reset the Podcast is a Let's Reset and Advertising Week global production. Executive producer is Richard Larson, with me, Suki Thompson. Thanks to our sponsor, Liars Non-Alcoholic Spirits, and voiceover artist, Talitha Penny. Music provided by Audio Network.